Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to see everyone here. It's great to be here. It really is a pleasure to be in Cambridge again, and a privilege to address such a distinguished group of social media professionals from all around the world. I thought this was mainly a national audience, but I'm delighted that it's international. That's terrific. Princeton colleagues of mine have attended this conference in recent years, and they have raved about it. Brianna had kindly invited me to come a couple of times, and I wasn't quite able to swing it until this year. So suffice it to say that I'm really, really grateful to be here. I would like to add that a couple of years ago, a couple of the members of my team demoed in one of the workshops a social media strategy game that we developed at, in our office at Princeton, and it was well received, and we got requests to send that game all around the world. So thank you to the Social Media Summit for help getting that rolling. It was great to see. I am privileged to work at Princeton, and I take delight and pride in representing the university. I arrived there, as Brianna noted, in 2012, five and a half years ago. And social media at that time was a small portion of my portfolio and what our office did. In fact, our efforts then were a bit on the sly, experimental, a supplement to our main means of communicating through the university website and publications, which our office also oversees. So today, our social media platforms are not only a primary means of communicating, but they are integral and essential to our strategy for reaching audiences worldwide. We see the value of social media every day, and yet as I give this keynote address, I do wish to give you fair warning. We haven't always gotten it right. Take, for example, a day back in January of 2014 when the world discovered that a pair of Princeton graduate students modeling patterns of epidemics unabashedly predicted that Facebook would lose by this very year, 2017, 80% of its users. That was a tough day on social media. It was a tough week. We got hammered on Facebook. We got hammered by Facebook. We got hammered on Twitter. We got hammered by media reports all day long. And mercifully, the shouting all died down by the end of the week. And needless to say, Facebook is still very much with us today. With that viral episode in mind, I hope you'll understand that my remarks are going to concentrate a bit more on looking back than looking ahead. So since Brianna invited me, I've been turning over in my mind, really for the last several months, what I might say to help frame our discussions in sessions and in between here during our time in the Boston area. It usually serves me well to stick to the basics, and I'll start by noting that what I've always stressed with anyone venturing into social media is that it is as important to hear as to be heard. Today and tomorrow, and what I hope will be many exchanges in weeks and months to come, I intend to listen as much to speak and to learn in the process. So while I have the floor, I'd like to give you my perspective on social media, how it's evolved over the years, and how it fits into the broader transformation of communications in our world. My career has taken me on a long adventure over the past 3.5 decades, and here's how I break that down. I spent the 80s in the American Midwest at a newspaper in Illinois and with the AP in Wisconsin and Nebraska. The media at that time were traditional, newspapers, radio, television. None of us realized it at the time, but they were in the most glittering years of their golden era, making money, big money, unchallenged. I spent the 90s on the West Coast with the AP in Seattle and San Francisco. I was in the front row watching Microsoft develop, and these strange new things called the Internet and the World Wide Web came along. On the leading edge of that in the Bay Area, I was urging our editors back east to pay a lot of attention to these new trends. I spent the aughts, 2000 to 2010, in New York, New Jersey, and back in California, a decade bookended by the calamity of 9/11 and the lean years of the Great Recession. At the time, we're dinosaurs was a comment I heard from many editors and publishers. They were joking, but there was an underlying sense of worry that only intensified as the decade moved on. They were beset by a maelstrom of competitors, not only websites, but bloggers, microbloggers on Twitter, and so forth. Traditional media balance sheets no longer balanced. This will be a successful speech if I do not drop my script. During that turbulent time, I was fortunate to recognize that the center of gravity of communications was shifting as social media became more and more prominent. I'm very grateful to the folks at the Modesto Bee who handed me the keys to the paper's nascent Facebook and Twitter feeds and let me run with them in those early years. In this decade, I made the transition to Princeton with social media flourishing. As I look back, there's no question that the digital revolution really was a revolution. It overturned traditional models and strategies, and we're still sorting that out today and will be for some years to come. With social media, I like to look at their growth in evolutionary terms. Although it seems as if social media arrived like Venus from the waves, fully formed and beautiful, the process has been more gradual and nuanced. And it's also been very much Darwinian, with those who have been able to adapt, proliferating and thriving, and those who have not fossilizing as they failed. So let's go back in time, starting 15 years ago in 2002. That is when LinkedIn became one of the first social media creatures emerging from the digital ooze of the dot-com bust at the turn of the century. Then came 2003, MySpace. How many of us had MySpace accounts? How many still have them? I actually tried to see if mine was still live, but it's long gone. Let's see. Everyone pretty much knows the story of 2004, and it was based here in Cambridge. Harvard, America's oldest educational institution, spawned one of the biggest phenomena of our lifetime, Facebook. Next, in 2005, came YouTube, another phenomenon in communication. 2006, Twitter got its start, and thus some of the major social media players were in place, if only in larval form. It's amazing to me that Twitter's headquarters are right across the street from where I used to work at Fox Plaza at 9th and Market in San Francisco. When I was there in the 90s, lots of winos, we had a crack house across the street. Now it's one of the centers of the social media universe. I'm just stunned by the change. I haven't been back since they moved in, but I do need to check it out. Okay, in 2007, just take a guess as I speak here about what I'm going to show. It wasn't the arrival of a specific social media platform that was the highlight, but what turned out to be the platform that launched social media into permanent orbit, the iPhone. Steve Jobs put these little computers in our pockets and in our purses. The iPhone, the App Store was invented, and everything changed. It really was a pivotal moment. Facebook and other fledgling social media moved from a situation where people would maybe post on a desktop in the morning and then check in at night at home. And with the iPhone and other subsequent smartphones, were the first stirrings of my wife's threats to throw the phone in the pool because I was spending too much time on it. I tend to overdo it. On to 2008, when nothing happened. Well, actually, not really nothing. This was the year of the near financial meltdown for the U.S., and it had ripple effects across the year. Really, a lot of things slowed down, particularly in my industry at the time, the newspaper industry. What would lead us out of the recession in 2009? Foursquare. And I speak with authority. For many months, I was the mayor of the Marshall's discount store in Modesto, California. And then suddenly one day, I was in my car. I pulled into a Safeway grocery store parking lot and was about to post that I was going to enter Safeway, and I thought, this is nuts. Why am I doing this? And I just stopped. I have not been back to Foursquare since. Okay, 2010. That was another pivotal year. In the two of the major platforms launched, Instagram and Pinterest, and I've got the old Instagram logo there to remind us of all of that. And these platforms were focused, if you will, on images. And I'll discuss a little more on the importance of images as we go. Next, 2011. Brought us, well, a mix. Google Plus, widely regarded as a Johnny-come-lately, and it really has not showed much staying power. And also Snapchat arrived at the time as a one-to-one exchange of messages and images that went poof and left no trace. Snapchat was viewed at the time, if you recall, in large part as a way for teens to have a social network of their own where their parents weren't lurking in the background. 2012, and again, this is just 5 years ago, Facebook gobbled up Instagram. They paid $1 billion for it. That photo sharing app was making a lot of noise, and Facebook paid attention. They were starting to adapt. In 2013, Twitter made a significant shift, and adding photos and videos to its feeds. You know, I've been on Twitter since 2008, and I was startled to see that they've spent half their lifetime without photos. It's hard to imagine because they're such a big part of the Twitter experience. So in this Darwinian jungle of social media, on the heels of that Facebook investment, Twitter was also adapting to changing circumstances. As for 2014, not much to see here in LO, so let's move on. The next year, 2015, was notable for the emergence of live streaming on social channels. The relatively short-lived Meerkat on top, and Periscope, which is still with us. Facebook also got in the game about that time. And last year's big change was Instagram adding stories. And you can see the persistence of cats throughout social media history. But this was from their original announcement. This was their countermove to Snapchat, which had earlier instituted its own stories platform, moving away from that one-to-one model that they had used in the early years. So as we look broadly over these past 15 years, we see a pattern of evolution with startups emerging, surging, merging, and either prevailing or failing. Broadly speaking, there's been an arc in this social media evolution that started with text, added images, photos, and video, and in this latest phase has brought us live streaming. We've gone from, I'm eating a donut, to, here's a photo of my donut, to, hey guys, I'm eating this donut right now. So on that high note, we arrive at this year, 2017, in the Common Era, and social media growth continues to climb. It is the best of times, it is the worst of times. We have so many means of communicating today. We can reach huge audiences directly, and yet we're broadcasting amid all the racket, often straining to get our own messages heard. So coming in a little closer, we'll see that we have just under 2.5 billion social media users around the world. And this particular forecast shows steady growth continuing through at least the next 4 years. Now let's zoom in a bit on our own audiences in higher ed. I'll be focusing on stats from American colleges and universities for the moment, but although those of you who from other countries can certainly figure out equivalencies for your own neighboring institutions. Here in the States, colleges and universities have accumulated huge followings. These stats are probably a year or so old, and the numbers have really grown since then. They continue to climb. Harvard, for example, has more than 5 million followers on Facebook and Twitter combined. At Princeton, our total is nearly at 850,000 followers. That's about the size of Charlotte, North Carolina. And between the two services, and if you add Instagram and Snapchat, we are very close to 1 million followers. This chart only shows the primary university accounts. There's a much wider audience reached, of course, through accounts of the various departments and programs and professional schools and individual faculty members, administrators, alumni, students, and so forth. They all contribute to the impression we make on the world through social media. It's difficult to gauge total reach because, as we all know, not all of our followers see everything we post on a particular channel, and many only take a glancing look. On the other hand, as our followers share and retweet and repost our content, it gets served up to an audience much wider than our own standard followers see. So large followings are great, and they serve as a relative guide to popularity. But they don't bear out what really matters, which is reaching the audiences or individuals we want to reach and engaging with them. To me, our social media efforts are a success if on a given day, just one of our posts induces a talented teenager from a rough neighborhood in Sao Paulo or Baltimore who otherwise wouldn't think of Princeton to turn in an application. To reach that teenager, we have to be nimble and reach her where she lives. Just as the social media platforms have adapted to connect with their audiences, colleges and universities must do the same. Consider the challenges of trying to reach students, both prospectives and those enrolled. At Princeton, over the past several years, we've used Facebook as a broadcast channel to reach a wide general audience, including alumni students, their parents, and prospective students, particularly those overseas who never give our webpage a look. They don't even think about it. While parental engagement remains high, in the last 2 to 3 years, we have seen fewer and fewer students engaging with us. I don't know if you see the same, but we sure do at Princeton. A similar trend is happening on Twitter. It used to be that on the days we announced our early action decisions and our general acceptances in the spring, we'd see dozens of comments from Twitter students celebrating their getting into the university. About 3 years ago, a high school student in New York, they had a camera recording her opening up the Princeton admission portal, and then they showed this great video that went viral, or semi-viral anyway, of her and her classmates reacting and cheering and celebrating. But that was those were different times. Last year, this year, such posts have really slowed to a trickle. We still get occasional interaction with our students on Twitter, but these days it's more likely to come from Instagram or Snapchat, sometimes both. There is no question that our students and prospective students have shifted their attention to those visually based platforms. Take a look at the Instagram followings of a number of the schools that are represented here today. These are big, impressive numbers. At Princeton, for every 3 followers we have on Facebook, we have 2 followers on Twitter, and we have 1 on Instagram. The Snapchat number is smaller, of course, and hard to pinpoint, but if we have a student-focused message, we know that Snapchat and Instagram will give us the bigger bang than Facebook and Twitter. We don't simply use these visual platforms for visually oriented messages. We take a lot of care to pair compelling images and footage with text that addresses the primary university objectives, such as promoting the diversity of our students and staff and faculty, or the research that goes on at our university. Our best example of this combination of text and image is our Tell Us Tigers campaign. For those of you who don't know, Princeton's mascot has been, for 100 years or so, the tiger. Black and orange is the order of the day on campus. So Tell Us Tigers originates on Instagram, and then we cross-promote it on Facebook and Twitter. It's loosely adapted, and there's that evolutionary term again, from the Humans of New York campaign. Tell Us Tigers shows an environmental portrait of someone, solo or with others, as pictured here. And the text contains their own words describing some aspect of their life or their Princeton experience. We can tell from the comments on the Instagram post and those in the shares on other channels that these messages are getting through to people and often inspiring them. On a smaller, more concentrated scale, Snapchat has grown into an important platform to reach students, current and prospective. And that includes graduate students, but not quite as much as undergrads. One of our regular features during the academic year comes on Mondays when someone on staff literally walks around campus, snaps photos of posters for various events on campus, and puts it into a Snapchat story. And the engagement is amazing. When we first started doing this last spring, we were startled to find that one of the first weeks, more than 50 people had snapped the image of the poster promoting the flu shot clinic that was on campus, an annual event. And that really got our attention. We see that happening again and again with Snapchat. Snapchat has also been a great onboarding channel for our incoming students. In the past, we had middling results getting the newbies to use a hashtag on Twitter or Facebook for their incoming class. Nowadays, the freshmen form their own private groups on Facebook. They're still there, they just don't talk about it, and their parents do the same. But the kids will gladly share on Snapchat the photos of the Princeton t-shirts or sweatshirts that they're packing as they get ready to leave for campus over the summer. So we've built big audiences and we've learned to adapt to chase our audiences, to meet them on their own ground, if you will. In this last portion of my remarks, I'd like to concentrate on a communications job in which we all have a stake, and that's addressing the darkly shifting public opinion of higher education. At least in this country, and from what I've read and heard in different places elsewhere in the world. Simply put, a good chunk of the public is hurling eggs at the ivory tower. The Pew Research Center is a quite reputable a barometer of public opinion in this country. And I was shocked and unnerved to learn this summer that the reputation of colleges and universities has taken a serious hit. Let's look more closely here. The shift in attitudes toward higher ed over the past 2 years really is astonishing. Among those identifying as Republican or Republican-leaning, it's the Republicans are there on the left. 58% of Republicans are saying colleges have a negative effect on this country. In just 2 years, we've gone from a situation in which roughly one-third of Republicans thought that way, but now it's a majority, frankly, as I see it, for anyone to think or say that colleges and universities are detrimental to this country or any country is simply unbelievable. While working in daily journalism, I knew firsthand that a big chunk of the population loathed the media. As managing editor in Modesto, if I didn't get a call haranguing me or an email haranguing me about how biased we're every day, the day was incomplete. But to see higher education lumped into that category and getting the same treatment really bothers me. And although Democrats and the Democrat-leaning populace are nearly three-quarters liking us, roughly a fifth of them think we have a negative impact on this country. That's nothing to write home about from your dorm room. I take some solace in noting that according to an earlier Pew report, this is from 2015, colleges and universities are viewed in a somewhat more favorable light than other sectors such as large corporations, the national media, and labor unions. Nonetheless, these percentages sting. What has caused our fall on the right end of the spectrum in particular? Sean Westwood, a social scientist at Dartmouth College, spells out one reasonable theory here. Many of us are viewed as elitist indoctrination camps for the left. You can almost see us placing the electrodes on our students' head and saying, be liberal. That's not the case, of course. We're also educating America's future leaders in an environment in which facts don't matter as much as feelings. Terry Hartle of the American Council on Education explained this phenomenon recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education, when the preponderance of evidence compiled by our researchers points to an irrefutable conclusion, some people simply don't believe it. They cry fake news. We're also in an environment with the media echo chamber, when people's reading habits solidify on one end of the spectrum or the other. If there are any websites that glowingly promote the glory of higher education in hyperbolic terms, please tell me about it. What I see are news sites, and I use the term loosely, that delight in mocking higher education and our so-called snowflake students. So how do we counter negative opinion in these contentious times? Let's look at our social media platforms for solutions. One of the narratives from the right end of the media spectrum is that colleges, not the media so much as just the political spectrum, is that colleges and universities have become intolerant of free speech. Yes, there have been unfortunate incidents on several American campuses over the last year or so. Speakers shouted down, marches that turned violent. They're abhorrent. But these are exceptions, and here I'm going to quote from our president, Christopher Eisgruber, who's a First Amendment scholar. President Eisgruber says, if one were to judge by media reports, one might assume that the events at Middlebury or Victoria College in Texas were windows into the prevailing attitudes of college students today. I think that is quite wrong. On college campuses generally, and at Princeton in particular, disruptions are widely reported, civil discussions and peaceful protests are not. At Princeton, we have had protests and a day of action, teach-ins and so forth. Opinions on all points of the spectrum have been aired. When Charles Murray, whose visit to Middlebury College not far from here went badly, when he came to Princeton, we had a few people walk out to protest his presence on campus and his messaging, but the speech went on uninterrupted. Rick Santorum, former U.S. Senator and a leading conservative voice in this country, came to campus and came away impressed with our students on both sides of the political aisle. Here's how President Eisgruber described that. When the event ended, Santorum thanked Princeton students for being very polite and respectful. This is what should happen on college campuses, he said. Students responded with applause. Santorum then added, I don't agree with you on some things. You don't agree with me on some things. Hopefully you learned some things. I learned some things. That's good. It's iron sharpening iron. We need to get messages of that kind of thing happening before the public, and our social media channels with their broad reach really can achieve that. Consider the discussions that happen in all of our classrooms. These are not indoctrination camps for liberals or conservatives. Classrooms can be a crucible for debating moral and ethical issues in which our students make up their own minds. We should make sure that the stories we share on these classes bring that out. Our faculty present a range of views. They do not think or act in lockstep, and we should make that clear, too, through our posts. The benefits of colleges and universities can certainly be told and amplified by showcasing the work in our laboratories. researchers and the researchers that we are training for the future are working for the public good. Basic research and applied science can and do result in improvements in healthcare, transportation, consumer goods, and much, much more. At Princeton, we put it this way in our informal motto, Princeton in the nation's service and the service of humanity. And also, don't overlook the importance of arts and events on our campuses. Many of us have vigorous arts programs and lecture series, and we welcome the public to them. We increase the quality of life in our communities. At Princeton, we have an auditing program that allows people in town to sit in on our classes run by some great world-renowned professors. Messages of this kind of involvement between universities and their communities are really important to get out through social media. We now have a new level of evolution, live streaming to bring audiences near and far onto our campuses and into our classrooms and labs. At Princeton, we've had excellent results with live streaming. We haven't done a whole lot of it, but when we've done it, it has been really successful. Just before Halloween, the physics department sponsored a pumpkin launching competition. Yes, it's a cute Halloween theme, of course, but we didn't want people merely to come away and say, oh, that's fun, they're smashing pumpkins at Princeton. What we brought science into the equation, and we did that. One of the members of my staff, Danielle, with the microphone, served as a host with one of our graduate students who provided commentary as the postdocs and grad students who were competing in this event cranked up their equipment and dipped the pumpkins in liquid nitrogen and froze them, and they smashed and made a loud bang. But the science and the teaching were embedded in the fun. And that's a great message that social media can deliver better than just about any medium I can think of. Finally, I have a pointer on this. I didn't realize that. Finally, let's join forces. I'm gonna check the clock here. We need to work with each other and higher education groups and other coalitions to advance our cause and protect and improve our reputation with the public and with lawmakers and politicians. Many of us belong to international, national, and regional alliances. We need partners for our own mutual benefit. Institutions, public and private, large and small, local, international, we all need to work together on this. Allow me to close with a final thought. And that's we should continue to join forces with our students and our faculty members to promote our colleges and universities. Especially to counter the negativity that's out there. I imagine you find, as we do, that often our most effective spokespeople are our students, undergrad and graduates. We offer their own descriptions of their experiences. When they share them and we repost them, we send those messages out far and wide. That messaging can and always will be delivered to some extent in written form. But as I've noted, increasingly for our audiences, the power and importance of the image seems to grow greater year by year. As we continue to adapt our approaches to reaching audiences, I reckon even our cliches can evolve. A selfie, one might say, is worth 1,000 words. And that is all I have. Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy. Do we have time for questions,
yeah,
Brianna?
Yeah, we can do a couple questions.
Okay, great. And I should add, every one of us has a unique situation, unique challenges at marketing, at messaging, and so forth. So this is from my perspective. I'm sure it's different for everybody in the room, but I hope we found some common ground in here.
All right, let me bring you the mic so everyone can hear you.
Hi, my name is Vanessa. I'm from Babson College outside
Hi.
Boston. Hello. Thank you so much for your talk.
Oh, thank
your talk
you.
Is with... outstanding, and I hope you look forward to tweets about it. But one of the things I did tweet myself was, I think that you represent a next generation of marketing leadership that I hope that all of our colleges would be so lucky to have. Just with your knowledge of social and digital and being digital first is very impressive. So I guess my question to you is, what is your advice for your colleagues that in similar institutions or in other institutions who might be a little farther removed from it, and how we as their team as well can best partner with them to bring them to a level that perhaps that you are at now?
Well, thank you for your very kind remarks. I've used this approach throughout my career, a sort of guerrilla approach as we see new things coming down the road. And institutions, and I've worked for big ones in the media, and I certainly work for a large one in higher ed, aren't always ready to accept the latest, greatest, newest thing. And I'm sure most of us who work in social media have experienced that. So with the internet in San Francisco, you know, there were buses that had URL addresses on them in like 1996. Nobody in the Eastern time zone had ever seen anything like that. And I would either phone New York or go back to New York headquarters and say, hey, this is coming, pay attention. And I'd try to sneak in a story here or there. At Princeton, as I said, when I got here in 2012, social media was, again, it was an experimental stage. But we showed over time how effective it could be. When we had a positive reaction to a story on social media, I would share that with senior leaders. I'm a step up the ladder now in my current role than I was when I arrived. So I would pass it up the line and just say, look, here's how our president's address on topic X got a reaction. One really effective way for those of us at universities and colleges is to show alumni reaction. I mean, there are so many things that can go wrong with alumni. My alma mater is considering changing its mascot's name and image. That's going to be a big stink over in Worcester in the next few months. You know, showing how the alumni react really is a great way, at least at Princeton, where we're very alumni focused. We have 93,000 living alums, and they all have an opinion. So we try to show the reaction and how social media really can be that listening device. And it's also helpful with what if our students are chatting about something, or chattering, as the case may be. That helps our student life managers get a handle on the way things are going on campus. So really, we have to build the case that this is effective messaging. It's a great listening device. And it's a campaign that you have to go on. So everybody's at different places. So, but don't be afraid to experiment. Any other questions?
Hi, my name is Chris. I'm from NYU. I wanted to ask you because one of the things that Princeton does particularly well is you're transparent. You've got your blog that's telling things, and you're putting information out there. Obviously, not too much. You're not giving away all the every little secret. But what do you say to other leaders about the importance of transparency in this industry? Because I do think we're fighting a challenge altogether. And even though we have some of the same students that we're competing for, it's important.
Yeah, well, thank you for recognizing that transparency, or at least the old college try at it. We decided when we had some unrest on campus, well, there were a couple years in a row of unrest, protests and so forth, that we decided that we should represent to the world that was happening. In fact, one of the photos on one of those slides was of a student with a bullhorn and a small group. Probably in 2014, there was a student walk out of class one day, and we put up the fact that students had gathered, and I think we maybe did a photo or maybe a video snippet on Twitter. And later in the day, we started seeing tweets directed at our friends at the University of Chicago, which was also having a demonstration that day, and they're saying, hey, Princeton's reporting on this, why aren't you? Well, one of the differences was our students stayed on campus. Theirs moved out onto the city streets, laid down and blocked traffic. So if it's on campus, it's a little easier to manage. But we want to be truthful. We want to be forthcoming. I mean, we certainly manage messaging. We don't lay everything on the table. We have strategies on what to say and what not to say. It's every college has to or university has to calibrate that. So it really is valuable to get basic information out there, address questions, get back to people if they have a question, even if we can't say anything at the moment, say we appreciate your question. A lot of what we do on social media channels is let people who say, hey, I've got an issue with this, we let them know. We are sending this to the proper people at the university who can respond. And I think we're past the point where students and others are surprised that we respond because we do it pretty consistently, and that's a good place to be. I hope that covers it. Anything else?
Hey, doing? My name's Jordan. I just had a question. So obviously, organic social media is extremely important. But does Princeton have like a strategy for like paid targeting of ads or anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, none. Well, that's not quite true. our central office. So Princeton is set up. It's sort of a confederation of cats wandering about. We're the center, and we lead by influence and example, and so forth. And yet there are other communications teams in the engineering school, for example. We do work with them and so forth. But so the only unit at Princeton that actively advertises on social media, and it's mainly through Facebook, is our Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. They have an international conference that they put on roughly yearly, maybe 1 year and a half gaps in between, and they have had tremendous success when they've gone to different countries with this program to announce it and get reaction. Often it's reaching our alumni who live in that region. But as a rule, we have not, in my 5.5 years at Princeton, we have done one Facebook ad, and that's when we were knocking on the door of 100,000 users, and we put a note up that say the student that we hear from that once we pass $100,000, we'll give an iPad away. I don't know if iPads have any appeal to students these days. They seem to have drifted a bit. But that's the only one we've done. And we figure, from what we've seen, and I have no science to back this up, once you start advertising, I think you're stuck paying. I think that's just the way it is. So we have managed, and we've seen ups and downs over time. And we are concerned. I know Facebook, I guess, is considering a sort of friends-only feed and having a commercial feed. That could really upset things for not just for us, but for consumer companies and all manner of commercial ventures. So that's something to keep an eye on. But we just don't do it. We have not found the need. We have a large following. And again, we have a great base of people who pay attention to what we post. So there may be occasions when we would probably want to use it on a strategic basis on a particular event or program or issue. But at the moment, so far, we have managed to stave that off. And I have no budget for such anyway, so that makes it really easy. But really, it is a strategic decision not to engage that way. But that's for us. You know, if you're in a competitive market with 5 or 7, I live across the street from Rider University, just south of Princeton, and they're in a competitive fight to bring students in all the time for a school. And I'm just using Rider as an example. I don't know if they do it or not, but for a school in that situation, those investments on social media, they are tremendous values for very little outlay of cash. You get a tremendous audience back. So it really depends on what your needs are. Again, we don't do it, but we're in a different category because we have more applicants, for example, than we can fit. We're one of the most selective schools around, and that makes it easy on the marketing side, if you will, because we don't have to do it. But other needs, it's a really effective. We did it in Modesto to great effect when I was there, and that was in the early days of Facebook advertising. And we really wouldn't do Twitter, I think Facebook, because of the audience is so huge and so targetable, would be the place to go.
All right. Sorry, we're out of time.
You're out of time, okay. I'll be around through tomorrow, so please come by, let me know what, and thanks so much for your
time. Thank you so much, Dan.